Solitaire Rose Radio, Episode 22, World War Kaiju, Part 2, with Patrick McAvoy. If you listened to part one, you heard me interviewing Josh Finney and Kat Rocha about World War Kaiju and their new publishing company, 01 Publishing. Cut in the middle of a story because artist Patrick McAvoy called up and wanted to be a part of the interview. This episode is with him. We talk about not just World War Kaiju, but his other art, and we get into the different art styles. If you pick up World War Kaiju, and I strongly suggest you do, you'll see that it has an overall art style, but there are other art styles within the book. Patrick talks about his influences, kind of where the vision comes from for the different pages and the looks of the characters, and how it truly was a real collaboration. It's a fun conversation, and I hope you enjoy it. Patrick, are you there?
This is Patrick speaking to you.
All right.
Woo!
Yes. Woohoo.
Patrick! Our art rock star.
Yes.
Yes.
We now have the artist of World War Kaiju with us.
Yes.
So this might even be... Well, we're already at an hour and a half. Well, hour and 15, so this could be two episodes again.
Very cool.
Wow. Okay, yeah, I was just living the rock star life, you know, lazing around and woke up with empty liquor bottles and hookers and...
Got your 40s and your bitches. Coated in paint, you hope.
Jeez, you guys, November's much better than mine.
So why do you need bitches and hoes? You already got a hot girlfriend.
Yeah.
Yes.
Hey, she's got drugs. She's got access to drugs.
Access to the good stuff. Well, I don't need that when I've got the 40s, you know.
Yeah.
And a sexy nurse outfit. Well, scrubs, but.
Sexy scrubs.
Oh, so it's the real nurse outfit.
Yes.
So we've been talking about publishing and
yes.
01 and all these other things. We have Patrick here. So Patrick, I want to talk a little about your art on World War Kaiju. First off, I mentioned before you were here that it looks much better on the page than it did on the screen, and it looked very good on the screen. But it's also this big, like, widescreen experience. The book is printed sideways of a regular comic.
Mm-hmm.
And was that your decision? And what was the difference between doing that and doing a regular vertical comic page?
Well, two good questions. The first question, I am trying to think back into the misty mists of time, and I think maybe Josh first came up with that thought.
Yeah,
is that right?
I wanted it widescreen because it had such a cinematic feel that it really needed the same long angles that all the kaiju movies needed. You know, those monsters all had tails and, you know, were usually longer than they were tall. And you have these epic fights across cities and landscapes. The widescreen was highly necessary.
And I really bought into that for a few reasons. First being the fact that we did want this to have a nice home on computer and mobile devices, and it seemed like a real natural fit for that size. And then the other was that my previous graphic novel I'd done, which was called Starkweather Immortal from Archaea, I had tried to do the sort of traditional widescreen panels quite a bit, and I discovered, as I think everyone who's tried to do that sort of layout has discovered, that it's very limiting when you have a page that's not laid out for widescreen and you're trying to fit widescreen panels in it. You basically are cutting off a lot of people's heads or having them crouch a lot. And when Josh said, what do you think of doing this widescreen? I kind of jumped on it. That is a great idea. So
actually, there was also a second reason to do it that format, and that was because we did want it to look good on screen for people who were going to read it digitally.
Yeah. Yeah, the whole thing looks wonderful on the computer, yeah, you know, on a general home computer screen as well as a tablet. So
they have such the wide format proportions like the screen does.
Yes, that's the other thing I'm noticing with reading comics digitally, and I've said this a few times, in certain other podcasters have smacked me down, but I will stand by it. In a regular comic, if you're going to do it digitally, when you do a double page spread, you're basically saying, okay, this big vista is going to be half the size of every other page.
True.
But with the, when you flip it to fit the screen, it does give that bigger feel that it fills the entire tablet. But I do feel bad for people trying to read comics on their phone.
they've got to just really be desperate to read the story, to read it on the phone, because they're not getting much in the way of art.
Now, one of the things that we talked about were all the delays involved. And I wanted to ask you about how you felt about the fact that with Kickstarter, it got approved a year ago. Basically, it's like the editor said, okay, go, and then it comes out a year later. And you probably had your work done long before it came out because of all the publishing stuff going on. What have you been up to since you finished World War Kaiju? What other projects have you been doing?
I got to interrupt there. We already told you.
Oh, good.
Bitches and hoes. 40s and blunts.
Spending all that kaiju money.
that's right. It's been a nonstop party, cocaine haze for months. I mean, man.
It's like the original Saturday Night Live all over again.
Yes. Right. Oh my God, that makes me John Belushi. yeah, well, I do, art is my day job. Hey, there's a good film noir title. Art is my day job. And I do lots of different projects. I work in, multimedia and, I do, games and, other projects for mobile devices and also, for, educational, products that are done directly for educational publishers like Pearson, and I do other illustration projects. I was working on the Numenera game that just recently won a bunch of awards at Gen Con, and I did a lot of illustration for that. You know, little of everything. I did some work for World of Warcraft collectible card game, and my gosh. And another big project I did right after World War Kaiju was an 80-page kids graphic novel, sort of a young adult novel that I adapted. I did the adapted script and the drawing and the penciling and the coloring, and a completely different style from World War Kaiju. A little more straightforward.
Well, it kind of have to be.
So that was a pretty major undertaking, and actually that one's waiting to be printed right now. I believe that's going to be coming out from Caliber Comics. They're making a comeback, and this is going to be one of their first graphic novels.
Every time I hear that Caliber's coming back, I get very excited, because if you look at Caliber in the 90s, they published, you know, not everything hit the mark, but if you look at who they were publishing, those are the people who really were the main people of the next 10-15 years. And it shows that the editor there was just as really good at not just picking out talent, but helping them learn their craft and learn how to do things. So I look forward to anything they put out.
Well, knock on wood then.
Yeah.
Well, it's called The Nain Rouge. And, it's primarily, aimed at, sort of a young adult audience, but I think, grown-ups will probably enjoy it too. And it's a really good, it's one of those things, that you usually see in graphic novels. At the beginning, I was sort of tentatively trying my, you know, dipping my toe in the style, and by about page 30 or 40, I was really going, you know, by the time I hit 80, I could do that style in my sleep, and then I had to stop. So.
Talking about the art in Kaiju, it doesn't look like, when I think of comic art, it doesn't look like traditional comic art, but it also doesn't look like the computer over-rendered stuff that seems to be a problem. What was your process in each page? Was it all digital? Was it paper, then digital? How did you go about breaking it down and giving us what we see?
Generally, my process starts with some sketches on paper, just at my drawing table. I'll work out my thumbnails, usually with just a pencil. I'll print out some little half-sized templates on just regular printer paper and do all my sketches there. And then I will scan those in. First I'll send them to Josh and get feedback, which is usually, great, go ahead. he's a wonderful collaborator.
No good.
or else we'll sometimes say, I didn't even think of doing it that way. Go ahead. it's a dream come true. And so once I get that back, I'll scan those in and blow them up to size on the computer and then start doing a final drawing, usually these days on the computer. Sometimes if something really needs a nice pencil feel, I'll do the pencil drawing outside and scan it in, but it's usually panel by panel. So, you know, if I need one panel I think really needs to be a pencil drawing, I'll just do that one panel and scan it and composite it in. And then once everything is drawn, I will just start painting over it in Photoshop. And I do like to keep a lot of lines behind. It's not a real traditionally illustrated, you know, book cover kind of painting, because I do like to leave a lot of lines and a lot of that iconic power that you get from that I do think some people lose in their computer rendered comic book stuff. But of course, there is a great tradition going on now of fantasy illustrators, or a new tradition starting of fantasy and science fiction illustrators working in digital. So I'm pulling a lot from that world since I work there a lot. So I get a lot of inspiration from other artists these days who are working in that realm. And I don't think a lot of those techniques have really come into the comics art world yet. So I'm kind of hoping to bring whatever I can into it. And I'm really glad you think it had a lot of, didn't have that soft, over-painty look. That's what I really try to stay away from if I can. Obviously, I can go through the book and, you know, point at individual panels and roll my eyes and go, ugh, kind of dropped the ball on that one. But I guess every artist does that.
I think every good creator looks at their old work and hates it to the point where I've heard stories where Jack Kirby, people would bring up old stories and he would go, yeah, I loved it. I loved it. I loved it. And then when they walk away, he's like, oh, that was such a, to the point where somebody brought up, I forget the villain in the Fantastic Four, the really early issues, who his power was, he hypnotized people.
Oh, is that the hate monger?
No. Before that, I think it was Miracle Man.
Oh, sure.
The name.
Yeah.
To where
issue number
he was in an interview and somebody talked about how they brought that character back, and Kirby went, I was sick when I created that character and I didn't have any idea. So I just, you know, Stan and I said, well, let's just do a throwaway story to meet the deadline. And somebody liked that? Really? So as you started putting together your ideas for Kaiju, were there any artists who were inspiration, or was it the movies? And Josh, you could come in too, in the design of the characters, where did sort of the design of the characters visually come from?
Part of Josh is being played by Kat at the moment. He had to
sit
for a second.
Oh, he's got to tell the political people to quit calling. Okay, that's fine.
Exactly. But first off, I do have to say this before we enter this. This is how versatile Patrick is, and it segues great into this topic of what artists inspire Patrick, especially for Kaiju. It is amazing how many people think we hired 4 or 5 artists to do this book. Every single page is done by Patrick. And, you know, this was, I believe, Patrick's idea was to, as the story progressed and the tone changed, for the art style to change with the tone and with the time period and with the setting. And Patrick is so freaking versatile. He does so many different styles. Again, we've had people convinced we hired 4 or 5 different artists to do these pages, and it's all Patrick. So please continue. I just had to get that in there because it's amazing.
Well, I was not about to interrupt you. It sounded like really good stuff about me. So
it's always good when the editor is praising you.
Yeah. I just shut up and stand aside when that happens. but as to the design of, and thank you, Kat, so much. As to the design of the creatures, that was an interesting process. Actually, when I came on board, we were mostly talking about just having me help design the creatures. And Kat herself, the editor, has a great art background, and she had already been doing a few of the preliminary designs, and some of them actually, ended up being used in the final characters to a large extent of those creatures, especially our version of the Mothra twins. She did a great design for them that I kept almost completely. Mm-hmm. And, there were a few others like that. And, but I came on and started doing some sketches for creatures. And one thing we talked about really early on was to, make it look as though the creatures could all be in an old-time kaiju movie. In other words, they had to be either something that a person could stand in and move the arms and the head, or a puppet on the stage. They had to look like something like that. So we tried to go crazy with the different designs, but on the other hand, we always wanted to keep that constraint that we didn't want to get too far away from the person in the suit look. And that was probably just for our own amusement.
Iconic with the kaiju. I mean, you look at Cloverfield and it looks like a very, sleek animal, really. What's the iconic thing about the kaiju? It's a dude in a suit.
And I think Pacific Rim, he did a much better job with that because they do often look like dudes in a suit. They're fantastic designs. But they're very dude in a suit look. Yeah, we've got one character who's going to show up probably the next book, because I've designed, like 20, over 20 different creatures, not many of whom made it into the first book. And he is based on, Kat, help me, the one who's crawling on his hands and knees with the big knife on his on his nose.
Giran. Giran's the original character.
So we did our parody version of Giran, and I kept him looking like he could be a guy crawling on his hands and knees. Mm-hmm. That was a really fun sort of part of the aesthetic value that we really felt was important for the characters. And actually, if anyone wants to go by my, just look up Patrick McAvoy on DeviantArt. I have a World War Kaiju folder there, gallery. And if they look at my World War Kaiju gallery, they'll see lots of sketches and conceptual paintings that I did for different characters that are going to show up in future books.
Mm-hmm.
I like hearing the future books because they did drop that there will be a volume two, but it sounds like you're planning multiple volumes after this. And this will go to Kat. I know that on Amazon, you let me know that you were like 68th on one of the sales charts.
Uh-huh.
Other than, you know, the people who ordered it through Kickstarter, how is it selling both physically and through the various other online sources?
Very well. I actually just sent a shipment off to Amazon about 2 days ago, and I've got another one sitting on the floor at the moment to go off to Baker and Taylor. So it's been selling very well, which makes me happy.
That's one thing I find interesting with the smaller publishers. You talked in the Kickstarter thing about how it's you physically putting them in the envelope, slapping on the envelope, sending it out. You're putting them in the boxes and sending them to Amazon and the other. If you get bigger, where are you going to put all your back stock? Or is it, okay, this has to go out of print. Why? Because we're out of room.
No, that's a problem I want to have.
Okay.
You know, that is a day that, yes, it will be a challenge, but I will want to have that problem. Basically it means that we have to, up the storage space that we are renting.
Okay.
And I am also actively shopping for a distributor that will warehouse the books as well. So I hope that someday soon I can find a distributor that will basically take all of these books. And even though it means paying a monthly fee, it also means that it will go directly from the distributor's warehouse to the retailers. And there's none of the delay of the distributor telling me they need the book so I can send it to them, they can send it to the retailers. And again, that is a problem I want to have.
Okay.
Oh, and while we're talking about sales, I don't know if you mentioned earlier, the Kindle edition is for sale on Amazon.
Yes, yes.
And that's doing quite well, too. Mm-hmm. I look at it right now, and under graphic novels that they term historical fiction, because, you know, that's what we are. We're number 10. We're ahead of 300, An American Vampire, Volume 2. We're doing pretty good there.
Yeah. Wow, you're in the top 10. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
I almost feel like I should have Casey Kasem on the go. And now, back to the couch.
A very special dedication to today's kaiju.
Casey, where's your body at now? Right now, I'm in Norway. So I think I heard someone come back on the line.
Yes,
did I'm
right
did
here.
I hear that properly?
He has dealt with the solicitors thusly.
Yes.
Okay.
And with much prejudice, so.
Well, by the time people hear this, the election will be over. No, and they'll know that their calls didn't matter at all. I'm just happy that in about a week or so I'll be able to open my email box again.
Yeah, television will be a lot more fun too without the constant ads.
Oh, you know, I haven't watched a complete ad in a good 15 years.
It's gotten to the point now, if it's a political call, we just pick up and say we're voting Democrat and just hang up.
I wouldn't even do that. I just hang up on them. I don't say anything anymore. Just like, who are you? You know, I'm calling for so-and-so. Click.
I am on the thing called the Gallup panel, which just kind of fell out of the sky completely randomly. And the Gallup people called me up several years ago for just a typical Gallup survey. At the end, the thing randomly came up and said, hey, would you like to be on the Gallup panel? I said, what's that? And so basically they send me 3, 4, or 5 Gallup surveys a month. I'm sort of their, what do you call it? I'm the segment of the population that always stays the same. So,
oh, okay.
So I'm what they compare their regular calls against.
Interesting.
Yeah, so I guess I always have something to do with that. So that's
You're the
what
control.
I'm the control group, exactly.
They want to hear what you have to say.
That's what they keep telling me.
And that's all we want in this life. We just want someone to pay attention to what we have to say.
Of course, just last week, I got my very first one from them after all this time, the very first one where they actually asked, do you have a landline? It's like, you should be asking people that all the time. I got to say, no, I don't. Thank you.
Oh, my God.
Well, since we have Patrick on the line with us and we're talking World War Kaiju a little more, you've talked about how you want to do a second volume. Josh, in your head, how far do you see this story going? Is this a ongoing forever? Is this a we'll do 10, 12, 14 books? How do you see the build of the story?
Well, the build of the story, the ending was already known before it was started. It's called World War Kaiju for a reason, because you get a world war. That's not hyperbole in any way. And that's really what it's building towards. And this version of the Cold War, where ours, we got a lot of lucky breaks. In this one, anything that could have gone wrong pretty much did.
Okay.
And I've already got a significant portion of book two scripted. Some of the pages are actually already done. Patrick's been rocking on that. Ideally, I'd like this to be three books, but it depends on the Kickstarters. The Kickstarters will determine how many chapters appear in each book. But it'll take us all the way up to Vietnam. And let's just say it turns into the first World Kaiju War.
Okay.
So
let's. Gotta love pregnant pauses. That's what makes podcasting great.
Yes.
Yeah.
And Patrick, you're already working on pages. Do you feel that your art is getting better as you go along? Are you learning more? What's the big thing you've learned in doing this story?
Wow. You know, it's funny when you're doing art every day and sort of one page goes into the other, there's so many little micro plateaus you hit. Like, you know, one week you might say, oh, well, you know, I got good at this particular sort of brushwork, or the next day you might think, oh, I got better at, you know, mixing these particular colors together. It's hard to really tell, but I know one thing for sure from when I started World War Kaiju to now, I think my figure drawing is getting just stronger and stronger. I really feel, especially including that last graphic novel that we were talking about that I just completed, I'm getting a lot more confident with drawing figures, and that includes, you know, the giant monsters as well as the people. Every time I sit down to draw a person, I'm not just more confident with anatomy and, you know, things like that, but with, you know, drawing the figure in space and you know, the internal perspective on a figure, and also the acting that the character will do with their body and with their face, how they're standing. I always have paid a lot of attention to that. But it just seems to be, you know, coming a lot easier now. So I'd say that's probably the big thing that I notice, you know, year over year.
Okay.
The one thing that stood out to me, just to cut in, as being someone watching the script get realized, was seeing Patrick come into this, me being primarily familiar with his fantasy work, you know, dragons and classical monsters. And seeing him really embrace the concept of this blown-out Technicolor world, and just how he's really gotten to this point where he can mimic a lot of that cinematic motion.
Mm-hmm. Oh, thanks.
And just scale.
Okay.
I guess that is something I did get very comfortable with over the course of World War Kaiju. Yeah. Huh, neat. Okay. I'll take that. Can I quote you?
Yes.
Well, Josh, in your creation end, have there been things where you've seen that Patrick does really well that you want to play to those strengths where the story has changed?
I would say that's the entire process, really, of the book. I came at it with a script. Patrick was always my first choice. We didn't think we'd get him. And we were very, very lucky to find that he was on board from the moment we asked. Mm-hmm. And then it was very quickly learning how incredibly versatile Patrick is, how we could get away with lots of different style changes. But I think the number one thing that I learned was to trust his ability to stage a scene and to choose the optimal angle to really make a scene stand out and sing. When you're writing scripts, and prior to this, I've only written for myself. Prior to this, the only time I wrote for another artist was when I was helping Mike Colbert out with his Crazy Mary book. And seeing the scripts that I assisted him with and then the art coming back and realizing that certain artists, you really needed to hold their hand when it came to camera angles and positioning of characters. Then there were others that were good at it but didn't really take into consideration how it was cinematically going to flow on the page for motion or speech bubbles. The thing I found with Patrick is give him as much of an impression you want. He's one of those artists, you just give him the impression of what you want and trust that he's going to get it. And in his own visual mind, he's going to take that and then crank it to 11 and throw in an angle or a character state, a positioning that you didn't intend. There were points in which my layouts are kind of unique in that I actually was providing him with full page layouts with panels and reference photos and sketches of people standing to give him with speech bubbles in there already to give him a sense of what to work with. And occasionally they'd come back entirely different. And I'm like, oh shit, the characters are standing on the opposite sides of the page. The speech bubbles aren't going to match up. And no, I laid them in and they were better. And once that happened, it was just really learning how to write for Patrick to know that just give him the spirit of the story, not the literal image of the story, and let him go with it.
That's been okay. Fun for me.
Now, one other story question. Because this is historical, have you, in your research, come across something that you thought was really cool? Oh, I want to – that's going to change the story and make a difference. Or is it you did all the research, and now it's just – you're building toward that ending.
There were things in research of bits and pieces that have kind of found their way in. My knowledge of the history is pretty good to begin with. Patrick's is excellent as well, which has been really useful. He's fact-checked me quite a few times, which mm-hmm. is nice. Really, the nice part about this is, since it is kind of a parable where I was taking what was happening in these kaiju movies and superimposing it on top of the Cold War, those films were already a reaction to the Cold War, so a lot of the stuff I'm referencing matched up on its own. And a lot of those ideas, a lot of those fears were already in the films regarding incidences and events that were actually happening at the time, so it was not very hard to do. The kaiju genre began as a metaphor for the bomb. And the initial concept of World War Kaiju is, instead of a metaphor, it's literal. You know, the Manhattan Project produced a monster. It wasn't an A-bomb. It was a literal kaiju monster. So the structure of the story itself was me going through the Cold War and then trying to weave in all these tropes of the films to match up reality. And then, of course, make it go bad. You know, instead of eking our way through the Cuban Missile Crisis, as you'll see in Book 2, the Cuban Monster Crisis was disastrous. Instead of Vietnam ending in just this horrible, horrible quagmire, no, it goes to a full global conflict. And having characters who were almost living in the real world reacting to all this, you know, flat-out ludicrous stuff, you know, things straight out of 50s B-movies, and they're reacting almost with the sardonic deadpan. I would compare it to Kurt Russell's line in The Thing, where the thing, the head falls off of the guy, and it grows legs and eyes and runs off. It's, you gotta be shitting me. That's kind of the vibe for the whole book.
One of the things that I really enjoy about it is that you play with the actual historical stuff going on. And like you said, everything that can go wrong will, and at the worst possible moment.
Yeah.
So I, the Cuban Missile Crisis, I'm actually really going to look forward to, because I've been reading about that over the last few years and how we were really lucky.
Actually, the Cuban Missile Crisis was the first scene I wrote.
Okay.
So that actually was kind of the thing that informed everything else I wrote around it, was that was kind of the starting point, was this bizarre – we were in a hotel trying to find some rest and escape from the world, where we went out to this hotel, and where was it? It was in the middle of the desert.
Oh, Prim.
Yeah, we went to Prim out in the middle of the California desert. Just
Prim's in Nevada.
Oh, is it Nevada? Mm-hmm. It's right on the border.
Mm-hmm.
And we were just we were dealing with a lot of contract shit. We were dealing with family stuff. It was a rough time, and we wanted to be someplace where there were no phones, no family, nothing, no lawyers. And I had this idea cooking in my head, and I was in the hotel, and I ended up writing this monologue from Hampton that turned out to be around 20 pages, and that was the starting point for the whole book.
Okay. Patrick, what was it about the pitch that made you jump on this project? Was there one thing that jumped out? Was it reading the whole thing, or was it, I want to draw big monsters, or what was the thing where you went, okay, yeah, I'm going to throw in my lot with this?
Poof, wow. They didn't the script wasn't done yet. It was pretty much a concept when I came on board. There were a lot of ideas, and like I say, Kat had done some sketches, and Josh had put together some reference and, you know, given me a taste of what the script was going to be like. But I think more than anything else, it was the fact that it had a lot of just very weird, subtle humor and nods to so many different things that it reminded me of Michael Moorcock when he does his strange historical humor mashups.
Okay.
And that's some of my favorite fiction is, you know, Moorcock's late 60s, early 70s, you know, odd, you know, like the Cornelius Chronicles, where you'll just go through these wildly different eras. And if you know at least something about history and philosophy and, you know, these different areas of interest, then you'll actually get the humor. And there's a lot of great laugh out loud moments. And for some reason, this whole thing reminded me of that. And it was something I really wanted to do. But I also have to say, at the same time, Josh was already talking about, you know, trying to do different styles, you know, somehow weaving in different stylistic things. And I just, you know, my imagination instantly went with that. And I said, oh, well, I could do this, and I could do this, and how about this? And, you know, suddenly he wasn't pitching to me anymore. I was saying I wanted to do it.
Okay.
And a third thing is, I already knew Kat and Josh from meeting when we were both with Arkea. We'd met at several comics conventions, and I just knew they were good people, and I'd want to, you know, hook up with them and try to do something together, and it was a great opportunity. So, three different reasons. I'm sure there's more, but those are the main ones.
Okay.
And another benefit to having Patrick on board that we probably would not have been able to find in any other artist was Patrick gets it, and he knows the time period stylistically so well that often I'd write something, and his own familiarity with the era and the fact that he gets the concept in his own twisted sense of humor, he would start working stuff into the background and adding stuff to the scene that was never intended, that just made it that much better. My favorite being the Don Quixote painting in the background, which in this world is a kaiju.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, those ubiquitous bad Picasso ink drawings of Don Quixote that you always used to see. Everyone had a print on their wall. And so, yeah, I had to put one in our main character's living room. He's got one, except in this world, instead of doing Don Quixote, Picasso was doing Kaiju.
But there's little details like that through the entire book that he threw in that were just wonderful. And I don't think another artist who didn't have the familiarity of the genre, the cultural zeitgeist of the era, the art style, I don't think they would have been able to do that.
No.
Well, thanks. Yeah, that is a good point, because and that's probably yet another thing that really excited me about it. He said, you know, he's saying this stuff, and he's saying, you know, you can do stuff from the 40s and the 50s and the 60s, and it's like, are you kidding?
Yes.
I'm on board. You know, book two, we're gonna bring in bad Japanese spy movie tropes.
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
I'm totally there. Yeah.
Now, one of the things I liked about this is you do play with genre, and Josh has talked about he was going to do another genre, which is Cthulhu meets noir.
No, that's just Patrick and I together.
Oh, Patrick's doing that one too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but I was going to ask Patrick, what are your favorite genres to play with?
Well, yeah, unfortunately, that might be redundant because I think it's about the same as Josh.
Okay.
But I've been just chomping at the bit to do more noir by way of Lovecraft. And that's one of the earliest projects I did way back in 2004 or so. I started doing the Call of Cthulhu collectible card game, which is all a period piece. It's Lovecraft, you know, set in the 20s and 30s. And I was already really into that era. You know, I think most of my favorite movies are from the 40s, frankly. And I love the noir era. And I grew up, my first thing that I read a lot of was the Doc Savage reprints. I think I was about in the fifth or sixth grade, and I went through at least 50 or 60 of the Doc Savage novels from the 30s and 40s. So okay. I was like the only kid in school who spoke like he grew up in 1935. And yeah, so when I got the chance to do that Call of Cthulhu card game, it really all came together for me, and I'd been chomping at the bit for a chance to do maybe my own property in that playground when Josh mentioned doing something Lovecrafty, and then he and I just had some long conversations, and a very strange love child was born out of that.
Okay.
Yeah, I think it should be mentioned, and I will be reflected in the credits of the book, and I think as we move forward with this new project, whereas World War Kaiju really did germinate from an idea that came out of my head at 2 in the morning. This next story, which is kind of Raymond Chandler meets Lovecraft, really is a collaboration. It was as much of a creation of Patrick's as mine. So, and that's it's far more collaborative.
Actually,
from the onset,
it's fun watching them play idea tennis and bounce things back and forth.
Yeah, and we have found, I don't know if I should say surprisingly, it's always surprising when you find something like this, but we have found that we really work well together, coming up with ideas, coming up with characters, settings, and it's like a big jigsaw puzzle, except instead of the pieces all existing beforehand, we're sort of creating the pieces as we go. And
okay,
we'll say, hey, look, this fits here. And then, you know, Josh will say, oh, well, this fits here. And suddenly we're putting a thing together that was bigger than either of us even suspected.
Yeah.
Well, great. And one of the things thinking about this that I'm looking forward to is all the Bill Elder stuff that you could hide in the background of of this book. Because I've noticed the little things in the background of World War Kaiju. I almost am more excited about, okay, what's the little things that are going to be hidden here that people will have to kind of put two and two together to fit? So
Bill Elder's a great, very appropriate thing to bring up when it comes to this new project we're doing, because yeah, suffice to say, it's going to have a lot of EC influence.
Okay.
My part of it. The art is really...
The visuals are awesome.
Oh,
they really are.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm really going from my influence from the EC artists and then from the Warren artists from the 60s.
Okay.
So, just a lot of the same
EC folks. For the most part, were the same
exactly.
artists.
It was either the same artists or people who had grown up looking at the EC artists. So, yeah, that's definitely where I'm coming from. It's going to be my chance to really... get good at that. Maybe
okay.
I'll have an opportunity to kind of perfect that style.
So is this going to be in color or black and white? Because I could almost see this working better as black and white then.
Black and white.
Oh, absolutely black
okay.
and white. In fact, there's a piece up, a two-page spread I did. We've done the first five or six pages of it already. And there's a page up on my DeviantArt account of that also. So, you know, we could send you some links to all this if you want to put it up in show notes of any sort.
Sure.
Yeah, and people can kind of get an idea of what that's looking like. A lot of blacks, a lot of textures, a lot of stark black and white, but then a whole lot of... German expressionist kind of
yep.
layouts. I hope if I'm not sounding too full of myself.
Well, if you're going to go noir, you have to go back to that German expressionism because that's kind of where it came out of.
Yes.
And then mixing it with the EC, you're right in my wheelhouse because I'm going, oh, I could really see some Kriegstein stuff in this,
mm-hmm.
but mix that with some Graham Ingalls, and that could be really cool.
Well, thanks. Yeah, I was sitting around musing to myself when I was feeling all full of it and thinking Kriegstein when I was coming up with layouts for this one. So who knows? It might be okay.
All right.
Actually, one of the stylistic left turns we take in World War Kaiju is a two-page sequence that Josh was sort of making our Jaws parody. And
okay.
When I saw that, I thought, oh my gosh, I have to do this in Al Williamson style. So
okay.
That two-page one is really my homage to Williamson mostly. And he did one story in particular for Warren called H2O that had a lot of water and boats on the water, and it was absolutely my homage to him.
Okay.
We've got a lot of comments on that sequence, by the way. I mean, everyone loves the cinematic Technicolor style that most of the book's done in. But when everyone comes upon that scene, that really sticks out. They really love how that just shifts directly to that style.
It's either that one or the Carl Sagan.
Oh, yeah. Well, everyone just loves Carl Sagan.
Yeah.
But, yeah, a lot of people like how just... And I was glad people got it. Mm-hmm. That they, suddenly you're kind of in his head. That's how Sagan sees the world.
Exactly.
Yeah. Oh, the Carl Sagan scene. I hope people all go out and... buy World War Kaiju just so that Cat and Josh get wealthy, but I but I'm really proud of it, so I hope people go take a look at it and see some of these things we're talking about. The Carl Sagan scene, I got to do Steranko. Woo! That was really neat. Steranko did one issue of a book called Our Love Story. He actually did one short story in that book. Yeah. And he did a completely different style, as Steranko often did. He said, well, I'm going to do a love story. I'm just going to invent a whole new style. How about that? That's the sort of thing Steranko would do. So
now, are you following him on Twitter?
Yeah, he's
his Sunday nights are amazing.
He's a firecracker. He's amazing, yes. Everyone should go follow Steranko because you never know what he's going to say next. And he's so smart and incisive and doesn't care, what he says.
And also, to kind of plug myself, mm-hmm. if you go back through the Solitaire Rose radio archives, you'll see an interview with Greg Theakston, who was his first art assistant.
Oh, neat.
Where Greg talks about how for a horrible, horrible summer, he redid the building.
Oh.
And that was his art assisting. It was stripping out the wallpaper and all this stuff. And he was paid in 25 cents once and dinners.
Oh. Wow.
And then I found out that one of the gentlemen here lives in the Twin Cities, took Theakston's part, and then when he moved back to the Twin Cities, he started the mid-70s comic book convention here, Joel Thingvall. So we've got this Sternako connection all through.
Yeah.
And yet won't let me interview him.
Oh. Actually, I got to interview him once for my podcast, Ninja Mountain, which is an artist podcast I do. I got a short interview from him at San Diego Comic Con. He was really nice. I just went up to him in the morning. He was at somebody's booth that weekend. I said, "You mind if I interview you?" He said, "Come on back in an hour or so." And I came back, and there he was. And I got a good, I'd say about a 10 or 12 minute interview.
I'll have to search that one down, because he's one of those artists that I find fascinating in that he came into comics, wasn't there very long, changed everything, and then just moved on.
Yeah, yeah. And like I was mentioning, it wasn't like he even did all the same thing. I think he did something like, 40 or 50 issues of comics, if that.
Yeah.
But he wasn't doing the same thing the whole time. He started out sort of being a bit of a Kirby clone and went into a sort of pop art thing. And, you know, he did some straight superhero stuff. He like invented the spy genre in comics. And then he went on to do that, My Love Story issue where he did a completely different style. He did that one style of, what was the horror comic he did?
Tower of Shadows.
Tower of Shadows, which, you know, you look at that, and that is the beginning of that stark black and white look that Frank Miller ended up using years later. It's a direct antecedent. And, he just, everything he did was genius. And then he left comics to go do fantastic painted book covers in acrylics.
Yes. And magazine design.
Right.
We forget that he did Foom.
Yes, he was the Friends of Old Marvel creator. Exactly.
Yeah, he put that magazine together. He had his own magazine called Preview.
Mm-hmm. And a comic scene, which morphed into Media Scene.
Yeah.
I actually have some old issues with that. I've got an issue of I guess it's Comic Scene, where he has a several page spread on his step by step painting process. So of course I had to go on eBay and buy that.
Okay. Well, we're getting near the end because I have to take off here in a bit. So why don't we go around the room? You guys plug what you got for sale, because you're not on here for your health. You're not on here. You're here to sell stuff.
I don't know.
Okay,
it's always good to talk to you, Corey. I don't think we talked to you enough, honestly. But
this is great. I could go on talking about old comics all afternoon.
Totally.
Honestly, if you ever do a show topic like that, Corey, you should bring Patrick on. But you get him started on that or music. You will get a
history
lesson.
Well, I am doing a series on EC.
Oh.
Where I'm going to go through like a five issues of each EC series till I get them all done. But like my Kirby series, I get it done. I do the weekly podcast with my friend Joe. Solitaire Rose is when I have time off and have all my research done. So that one did not as often. But Patrick, I will keep you in mind when I go through the EC stuff. I have someone who's going to help me with Mad.
Mm-hmm.
Since you've expressed your love of Kriegstein,
mm-hmm.
maybe you and I could probably talk for a good hour and a half on Master Race.
Oh my goodness, yes. And that one story, yeah, you can break that down so many different ways: storytelling and artistically, pacing, composition, and just subject matter. Ugh.
And also the background of the story, where That's the story that got him fired.
Exactly. Oh, yes, just talking about the way EC used to do their lettering.
Yep.
Brilliant. Oh, yes, we're a couple of geeks.
So, Patrick, what sort of stuff should people go to if they want to see your art and want to buy your stuff?
Well, they can go to my website, which is megaflowgraphics.com, just like it sounds. That's actually a reference to Moorcock again. It's the Megaflow. So megaflowgraphics.com has a smattering of different art that I've done, from illustration to comics to multimedia and games. And there's a link on there to a store where I have a few things for sale, prints and whatnot. Also my DeviantArt gallery has lots more art. You know, that the DeviantArt's a great place to just dump new things and see what people think. And a lot of the stuff on there is available as prints through DeviantArt as well. And then everyone should keep a lookout for Nain Rouge, which is again going to be published from Caliber. I don't know when the exact date is yet. They're just getting that off to the printer this week. And that's pretty exciting, because that's the first thing I've done adaptation myself on, so I'm responsible for a lot of the story. The script is still originally by the writer of the book, but I did the all the pacing and the graphics and turning them into word balloons myself. I even did the lettering on that. So that's real soup to nuts, all me. Everyone should go out and buy World War Kaiju, of course. They can see a lot of my stuff in the Numenera game from Monty Cook. All the different the books. It's a role-playing game, so various rule books have my art in it. And everybody who's an artist should go take a listen to Ninja Mountain, which is a book podcast I do sort of irregularly these days, but there's about 125 episodes out now.
Oh, wow.
That's with a bunch of artists from all over the world, who are people that you may or may not know, but are really top-notch fantasy science fiction illustrators. And there we go.
There we go. Josh?
I'm going to let Kat handle that, since she's the business person. She runs the company.
Okay. Well, you can find us at 01publishing.com. That's the numeral 0, the numeral 1, publishing.com. You can find all of our books on Barnes & Noble, Amazon, and also if you tell your local retailer to carry our books, the distributor that we use is Baker & Taylor. And that is where you can find World War Kaiju, Whispers from the Abyss, Volume 1, and Whispers from the Abyss, Volume 2. Again, we are having the open call, so visit 01publishing.com to read the rules and submission guidelines.
And also buy Utopia. It's my other book.
Yes, and buy Utopia. It's a cyberpunk noir story about drugs. You'll love it.
And that's on Amazon also.
Yes. Available. All right, our five paperbacks are sold.
Well, thanks, everybody, and I'm sure that we'll talk again soon.
Definitely.
Excellent. Good talking to you, Corey.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And with that, I had to get going. We could have talked another 2-3 hours, but I did have to leave. So, again, I hope you enjoyed the conversation. Please go take a look at 01 Publishing. World War Kaiju is a fun book. I cannot recommend it enough. And while I have yet to read the Cthulhu book, I am interested in Cthulhu short stories. I'm actually just really interested in short stories because, as I said, I don't have a lot of time for full novels. It's a very busy month. Speaking of busy, next week I have another interview. I will be interviewing web artist and personal friend Jin Wicked, who you can find out more about by going to jinwicked.com. And there's a lot of stuff coming up. It's going to be a very busy winter. And yes, winter is here. I'm looking out the window. It did snow. So I have not watched Game of Thrones, but winter isn't coming. Winter is here. I'd like to thank you for listening, and I'd also like to thank these guys, our sponsors. Sponsor number one is DreamHost.com, of course. DreamHost.com is the best bar none web host in the whole known universe. I enjoy just how they help me get the website taken care of, because let's face it, I'm not real good at the tech stuff. My other sponsor is Graze.com. Graze.com gives you healthy snacks. You can now get a Graze box every week. It's healthy snacks sent to your house. They put together different things and mail it to you. It's great, especially at my office job. I take the box and I put it in there, and I have snacks for the afternoon rather than going down to the vending machine and getting something that's terrible for you. I try very hard to stay away from those things, and with Graze.com, I'm able to do that. If you use the code Corey S3R5P, that's C-O-R-Y S3R5P, your first and fifth box are free. We also are affiliated with Dollar Shave Club, which is a cheap way to get good razor blades. They offer all sorts of other options. They have skin balm. They're basically branching out into men's personal care items. And I get the stuff from the Dollar Shave Club because I got really tired of going to the store and having to pay $20 to $30 for 5 razors. When you can go there, you can get razors for $3, $5, and $7 delivered every month. And you can join in the fun. Go to dollarshaveclub.com/crazy, K-R-A-Y-Z. I love getting feedback. Feedback is the lifeblood of a podcast. So you can contact me by email at corey.strode@gmail.com. You could go to my Facebook page, which is Solitaire Rose Radio, or you could give me a call. Our number is 952-856-0519. Now, if you're thinking of advertising on Crazy Comics and Stories, you can. Just contact me at corey.strode@gmail.com, subject to advertising. And if you're a creator who would like to sit down for an interview, or you've got an interesting story, email me at corey.strode@gmail.com, subject Solitaire Rose Radio Guest. I'll talk to you next week, and keep finding the good stories out there.